The stories we love inform how we live and sometimes change our lives. That's why the short stories in Daniel Stern's new collection, Twice Told Tales, take their inspiration and titles from writers and thinkers Stern loves. There's The Liberal Inspiration by Lionel Trilling, a story. A Clean, Well-Lighted Place by Ernest Hemingway, a story. And others that pay homage to E.M. Forster, Henry James, and Sigmund Freud. Stern says that he's always found time to write, but hasn't always made his living as a writer. He's been a cellist for the Indianapolis Symphony, an advertising and marketing executive for CBS and Warner Films, and now he directs the humanities programs at the 92nd Street Y in New York. The stories in Twice Told Tales revolve around different ways of leading a literary life. I asked Daniel Stern if when he was young and starting to write, he yearned to live the literary life.
Oh, it was an absolute dream. Of course, I was a musician at first. I was a cellist, and I went on the road with Charlie Parker instead of going to college. In fact, instead of going to my high school graduation, I went on the road with Parker. But I was already scribbling a bit, and then when I was off in the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, sort of exiled in Indianapolis, I was reading the Partisan Review and eagerly desperate to plunge into the literary life one way or another.
Let me back up and get back to Charlie Parker. What exactly were you doing with him on the road?
Oh, there was one of those, they did an arrangement called Charlie Parker and Strings, and they did a pickup group, and a friend said, hey, you want to play this gig and get to go on the road? You come back and you play the Apollo and Birdland. And I did it.
Were you on any of the With Strings recording sessions?
I'm on the black, I guess it's called the, not blackmail, the underground one. There were two of them. One was the recording of the actual performance we played, and the other is I was not in the studio one, no. That was my teacher, actually, Frank Miller, who was on that.
Mm-hmm. So here you were in the music world, and you really wanted to get into the literary world. What did the literary world mean to you, in besides sitting at home and writing?
I guess it meant a way to live saying what you want to say in fictional terms. It seems to me I always wanted to interpret the world around me, and the literary life was secondary. The actual literary activity was primary, and I've always been terribly social and also terribly eager to be alone in a room with a pencil and a paper or now a computer. So it just meant a chance to live in my imagination.
There's a paragraph I'd like you to read from your story, The Liberal Imagination. And this is a story about poetry readings in the 1950s. I mean, this is a paragraph about poetry readings in the 1950s.
Ah, okay. In the late 50s, I helped Gregory Corso organize the first coffee shop readings in New York. That was when he was still a tough street kid, fresh from his first readings at the City Lights bookstore. And an editor at Dutton asked me to pitch in on poetry. Poetry was going to be important. Years went by as in a dream. Poetry went back to being poetry again, i.e. peripheral. Publication parties became more elaborate. The network of referral editors I needed to keep a flow of work often resulted in a grateful invitation. It offered a social life of sorts. Ah, the secrets hidden there. Who trashed whose book in the Times for what not-so-secret motive of revenge or envy? How much editorial rewriting actually was done on whose Pulitzer Prize nonfiction book? Who was secretly homosexual when people were still furtive on that score, but enjoyed attacking openly homosexual authors? It was all a whirling cesspool, or it was simply the world, depending on how detached or how involved you were. I chose to think it was the world.
Did you choose to think it was the world?
Yes, I kind of think that's the way of the world. I mean, although I think there's a substratum of integrity in all this. It's just a sense of the world as marketplace, and literature too has its life as marketplace. As I say in the paragraph, poetry began to be important at the time of the poetry readings. Now it's the province of professors in universities. Well, I shouldn't say entirely, because I'm director of humanities at the 92nd Street Y, and we have the Poetry Center there, which has magnificent attention to poetry, but it's a rather special case.
Yeah, well, the series that takes place at the 92nd Street Y is really one of the best series of readings by authors probably in the country.
It has been since 1938, I guess, when T.S. Eliot read there.
Mm-hmm. You've not only written many novels, but you've also functioned as an advertising and marketing executive for movies and for television. And I was wondering how you got into that. It seems really far removed from the novels that you write.
Well, my original, the joke used to be that someone asked me, why did you stop being a musician? I said, well, I gave up the financial insecurity of being a musician for the financial security of being a serious novelist. And that kind of tells one part of the story. Then I gradually edged my way because if you can handle words, you can write advertising copy. And I began to write advertising copy in order to pay the bills, in order to sort of join society, get married, be a mensch, you know. And somehow, I never believe, and still don't believe, people who tell me that they are so drained by the day at the office that they can't write when they get home at night. I think if you've got a book to write, you'll write it. And I think writing advertising copy or any other kind of business writing taps your soul about as much as writing a letter to the laundry about some shirts they've lost. I mean, it can be fun to do, and it's a good craft, but it doesn't drain you. It doesn't tap your soul. Now, actually, my career got a little out of hand. I was just supposed to write copy and then go home at night and do my books. But I got a little too good at it, I guess, and then they promoted me. I guess it's the Peter Principle. Then I got to be in management, and I found myself riding through the gates of Warner Brothers in a limousine. And my wife said to me, how did this happen? And that wasn't the original idea.
What kind of stuff were you writing during your official working hours?
In the beginning, I was an advertising copywriter. Everything from Coca-Cola to Westinghouse to Buick to the usual stuff.
Some people would have a crisis of conscience that the same words that they're using to write their novels are the words that they're using to sell products that they don't necessarily believe in. That ever bother you?
Nope, because as a matter of fact, I try to deal with that in The Rose Rabbi. The hero of The Rose Rabbi, which is a comic novel, is someone whose job is he's an ethical advisor to an advertising agency. He sits in a small room with books with the Talmud and the ethics of Spinoza and advises them as to whether they can do this with that product and so forth. It was my attempt to deal comically with the dilemma, but the dilemma, I suppose, exists. I was never asked to do anything venal or anything I didn't believe in. Doesn't seem to me much to matter whether someone drinks Coke or Pepsi, and if I tell them to drink Coke, it's fine. They can make up their own mind. It's never occurred to me I had abnormal power. And I don't believe they're the same words you use, by the way. Contrary to what either moralists or the new deconstructionists will tell you, the deconstructionists from Saussure on will tell you that the basic structures of Jane Austen are the same structures as are in an ad or a matchbook cover. Well, I kind of don't believe that.
Have you ever written copy for your own book jackets or for your own press releases for your books?
I confess, absolutely. The book you have in your hand, I did a lot of the copy on the jacket.
Well, let me read some of it.
Oh, my God. Take it back. I lied.
Is this going to be horrible for you?
No, go on. Okay. My editor won't forgive me, but go on. It's all right.
Okay. This may be the most unusual love story in contemporary fiction, the love affair between an American writer and five great writers of the past. For some time now, these stories have been appearing in magazines, startling and entertaining readers with their fresh approach to the short story form.
Sounds right to me.
Is it good to write it yourself instead of leaving it in other people's hands?
No,
it can be very frustrating to have somebody else trying to describe your work and not getting it right.
Not really. Normally, I like to have them as someone else do it. However, this concept was so personal. And frankly, I mean, I'm not boosting this as a great big deal original thing, but no one has done exactly what I've done in this book. I was certainly involved in writing it, and I had the chutzpah to call it the most unusual love affair, et cetera, you know.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of restaurants and bars that appear in your stories, and there's business transactions that take place there, meeting people. Did you ever go to public places like that to write?
I spent approximately, 12 of my... I married rather late. I was a single semi-bohemian for about 12 years. And I hung around, but I was a bohemian in a kind of a dreadfully upscale style. I don't know where I had the nerve. I was a bohemian on the arm. In other words, instead of living like a real bohemian down in the village and really keeping a tight rain on your finances. I just lived it big, and I got to live in the... I hung out in the Oak Room at the Plaza, and I hung out at the Russian Tea Room. Russian Tea Room became kind of my home. In fact, the last story in the book is called... There's a restaurant called the Russian Rendezvous, which is rather transparently my great, beloved hangout, the Russian Tea Room. In fact, A Clean, Well-Lighted Place by Ernest Hemingway tackles that sort of directly.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, that's that sense of what it's like to be alone or with a friend in a bar and writing.
Well, I know I don't go to public places to write or to read now, though. Sometimes I'm stuck in them and have to work there. But when I was a student in college, I would intentionally go to, like, the student union or to the Rathskeller or something to work there, because it would keep me awake, and the hum of everybody would create the kind of white noise that would help me focus on what I was doing.
There's something funny about it. I can't figure it out. I still do it. There's a little place called Ireland on Madison Avenue, and when I leave the Y, I go over there and I have a Bellini, which takes me back to Harry's Bar in Venice, where I used to have Bellinis, and I work on a short story before I go home, which is 4 or 5 blocks away only.
Daniel Stern, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.